and yes, it is that time of the week again where we stand outside the library and simply just loiter around with literary loitering here on the Geek Show Podcast Network.
Well, we don't exactly loiter. Sometimes we cry because they won't let us in anymore.
We're going to stare through the windows forlornly at all the books.
The books that will never get read.
Yes, yes, yes. And then you see some kid running with a brand new copy of The We Free Men or something like that.
And you're a bit young for that?
Hey?
No, nothing.
Am I a bit young for that?
No, I was going like to say, is he a bit young for that? But
yeah, but at my age, you're all kids.
Okay.
You got to remember that important factoid.
Yes, yes, of course. As you can tell, my name is Owen, as has been said. I have a smattering of voices with me.
A smattering of voices with you?
Yes, I hear voices in my head.
I was a bit worried where this was going. You taking your medication? Hey, we're all safe now?
Nah.
Yes, I'm really. Andrew, the one who tells Owen to burn things. Burn them all, Owen. Burn them all.
He's gone.
Yes. And I'm Rob, the one who says, Owen, you know, you're a good lad. Don't worry. We're all good people here. You can put down that chair now.
I think I'll hold on to this chair, thanks.
So, yes, welcome to Literary Loitering. And we've got news.
Yes, we do have news, and I will start off with the news that apparently P.D. James was actually, like, a millionaire when she died.
Really?
Yeah, kind of. It's been revealed that basically her estate is worth, like, £22 million.
What?
Wow.
Yeah. Apparently, like, because basically, while she was an author, she also had a career as a civil servant, and she kind of made quite a lot of property investments in that time.
Well, because I was going to say civil servants don't get paid that much.
Yeah, but I think she kind of, within that capacity, had something to do with property.
Yeah.
So quite a keen eye for it.
Well, that's
apparently she had like 2 houses, 4 flats and a beach hut.
Wow.
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Maybe she frequented Homes Under the Hammer.
Possibly, with Dion Dublin.
the weirdest choice ever.
Yeah, 22 million.
Yeah.
I'm still kind of staggered. I can understand, like, you know, millions being made off Harry Potter, but this is P.D. James we're talking about. You know, but then again, crime thrillers are very, very popular.
Oh, yeah.
That's true, and apparently quite a few of her books got optioned into ITV dramas, so I guess that brought some money in as well.
That would explain a lot. That would explain why. You know, that would explain why she had so much money by then.
Because
as soon as it hits TV, you know, you got all the licensing fees, you got the advertising fees, all sorts of stuff like that.
That's when you make it.
Yeah, basically.
Yeah, I prefer having something on TV rather than a film.
Why?
I don't know. I think because the film can either go too big or it could just fail. With TV shows. It's easier to sell it to another network if it doesn't do as well as you'd hoped.
Actually, that's an interesting point, isn't it? Is it better to do have your work adapted for TV or for movie?
I guess on TV there's kind of that safety net, isn't there?
Yeah. That's a very interesting point you've raised there, Owen.
Thank you. I was quite surprised by that myself.
No, wow.
Yeah,
that's got me that one. What would I choose if I was gonna have something optioned? Would I option it for TV or for movies? As Owen said, it could, you know, with movies, it's kind of, you know, it's either a success or a failure.
Yeah, it's very sink or swim.
But with TV, you know, you can treat it as kind of a slow burn thing, and it'll either gain popularity or it won't. But at least it has a run on TV.
Mm.
And then it might just end up being like Jonathan Strange and Mr. Norrell, which is just like excellent.
Yep.
So, yeah.
There we go.
Interesting point. But yeah, I can understand why she's got 22 million however much of her stuff being on TV. Didn't make it to movies though, I think.
No.
She didn't make the transition into like big screen, did she?
No. Did she write Children of Men?
I can't remember, actually. I think we may have to Google. We summon the mighty Google.
By which we mean we will just use our inherent book knowledge.
Yes.
No. Google. I summon the
It's an actual being.
yes, I've cast the runes of Google, and they have told me that, yeah, P.D. James did write Children of Men.
Wow. That was such a good movie as well.
It was a really good film. Actually, can I make a confession?
Yeah.
So I think Children of Men was one of those occasions where I think I actually prefer the film to the book.
I actually think you're right. I think Children of Men works better as a movie than it does a book, and you get those on rare occasions where they actually do work better as a movie than as a book. I see some examples of it when I deal with like animation, you know, that, and when it's an adaptation of a book or a comic or something like that, I see it works better in it as a cartoon, just because it does. But with Children of Men, I think that with a story like that, if you don't see the characters in front of you, it makes it more difficult to visualize that kind of world.
Yeah, you kind of need that visual representation of just how bad things are.
Yeah, because, I mean, it is a post-apocalyptic story. The apocalypse has already happened, and the apocalypse was, we can't have any more kids.
It's a pretty effective way to wipe out the human race.
Yes, it is.
It's that'll just about do it.
I mean, it's basically just like basic supply and demand, isn't it?
Mm. Yeah. Well, the interesting thing is, because she wrote Children of Men, you know, I might have to have another dip back into P.D. James to see what else she wrote. Because Children of Men is post-apocalyptic science fiction, effectively.
Yeah. Well.
And if she's writing that, but her mainstay was...
It was crime novels.
It was crime novels. But if she's writing stuff like Children of Men, I might have to go back and revisit P.D. James.
Yeah, just to see how much stuff other she stuff has written that's deviated from that.
Because I really like it. It's one of my favourite post-apocalyptic movies, I've got to say. And if that's based on a book from her, then I might have been prejudging her as just a crime author.
Yeah, so not only does P.D. James have hidden funds, she has hidden depths as well.
Yeah. Weird. Weird how we've come to that conclusion. Okay, right. Moving on.
Yes, that's enough learning things for today.
Yes, enough learning things. Now time for the anarchy. Who's next?
I'll go for that. I assume you're all familiar with Stephen King.
Yes.
No, never heard of him.
Really? No,
I'm familiar with Stephen King. I used to go to school with him.
Oh, really? Was he a barrel of laughs?
Hey?
Was he a barrel of laughs?
No, he was kind of overweight and a bit of a bully, you know. He thought he was better than everybody.
Well, he's certainly lost a lot of weight in later years then, hasn't he?
And
yeah, he's also changed skin colour as well since then.
And aged a few extra years. Stephen King, the great novelist behind best-selling books such as The Shining and Carrie, received the 2014 National Medal of Arts from Barack Obama on Thursday.
Okay.
Along with 10 other artists.
Okay, so he's got the National Medal of Arts. Isn't that like a big thing in America?
Well, if it's been handed out by Barack Obama, yes, I assume it's probably a pretty big deal.
For an artist like that, to receive something as big from President of the United States, you know, that's got to be quite a good point for your career.
Well, this is what the National Medal of Arts is. It's an award and title created by the United States Congress in 1984 for the purpose of honoring artists and patrons of the arts. A prestigious American honor, it is the highest honor specifically given for an achievement in the arts conferred to an individual artist on behalf of the people. So basically, you know when they talk about the Congressional Medal of Honor?
It's kind of the art equivalent.
It's kind of the art equivalent of that. So the National Medal of Arts is basically the artist equivalent of that. So, yeah, it's pretty much the highest honour an artist in America can get.
So not too shabby, then.
Nice. So not too shabby. So would we say I don't know if there's a financial prize that goes with it, but, you know.
It's not like Stephen King needs a financial prize to go with it, though, is it?
Yeah, so this is true.
We agree that Stephen King is a worthy recipient.
Given
I don't know. I mean, let's not get carried away here.
Oh. I mean, he is a shining example.
Oh, interesting. There's some wordplay going on here.
There we go.
Interesting. How very, very interesting.
Yeah.
It's complicated because Stephen King, it's usually a game of two halves with Stephen King. You know, sometimes he's really, really good, and you know, stuff like, you know, The Shining, The Stand, you know, Carrie to a degree. But then you've got the dark half of him, which kind of goes to, you know.
Oh, we've seen the dark places.
No, The Dark Half. That's the name of a book.
Oh, I'm just gonna leave.
I can do wordplay too, you know. But yeah, you got, and he comes out with stuff like, you know, Insomnia.
Yeah,
and his horror stuff his latter year horror stuff hasn't really been that scary. I like Needful Things and stuff like that. I love the idea of Needful Things.
Yeah,
it was parodied really well in Rick and Morty, but it's just kind of, yeah. I'm glad he went back to the Dark Tower series, but I don't think he needed to do Mammoth Books to finish it off, because I liked the original trilogy that the Dark Tower was. And then he added like Wizard on Glass and various others to it, and it was interesting, but ultimately it just didn't quite work for me after the first trilogy. I think it was because the first trilogy was so good, and I was expecting more of that caliber. More,
yeah. It's always hard when you go back to something that you made beforehand.
Yeah, made like a couple of decades beforehand.
Yeah,
yeah. And I think that's one of the problems with going back to the Dark Tower Dark Tower series, and you know, going back to that. But I'd like to see King try his hand at other things. I like it when authors try their hands at other things, which is why I was surprised that I didn't know that P.D. James had written Children of Men, and why I'm going to be looking at more of her work. But with Stephen King, I know a lot of his work already. And so I'd like him to, because when he was writing under his pseudonym Richard Bachman, that was when he was doing stuff like The Running Man, you know. And The Running Man is a very, very interesting.
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of people tend to forget that he wrote that as well.
Well, he wrote Stand By Me.
No way. I might be thinking of something else, where it's like robots, but they're dying or something.
No, Stand By Me, as in, you know, the movie with the,
yeah, with Robert Pattinson, and surprise, it's 9/11.
No, not that one.
What am I thinking of? Why do I keep thinking of different things? Hell,
why are you thinking of Robert Pattinson?
I don't know.
I'm talking about Stand By Me.
It's his dreamy eyes, Rob.
Oh God. But actually, I just want to.
I'm talking about the Rob Reiner film based. It's based on the novella called The Body by Stephen King, and it's from 1986. That's Stand By Me.
Just a blank face.
It's kind of there in the back of my mind, but it keeps getting mistaken with other things. Like, talk out the entire plot of the film, Rob. I need it.
Basically.
Oh, the River Phoenix one.
Yes.
Okay, everything's fine now. I remember.
Everything's good.
But yeah, it's crazy that people don't realize that movie was based on a book by Stephen King. And like, when you tell people, like, really? The horror guy? Yeah, he wrote the book that Stand By Me is based on. Like, nah, because it's not a horror.
Yeah,
it's so not a horror.
Well, just, I still can't like wrap my head around the fact that Christine and The Shawshank Redemption are by the same author.
Yeah,
Christine is one of my all-time favorite films.
I mean, The Shawshank Redemption is like is a really, really good movie.
It really is.
And Christine is a story about a car that kills people.
Yes.
But don't forget, he also did The Green Mile as well.
Another really good film.
Like these really touching dramas.
Yeah. Why do I keep saying
the thing is, when you start looking at it from that angle, you start thinking, okay, right, now it makes sense why he's got the medal.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He can turn his hand to a lot of different genres and do really well.
The weird thing is, it's with The Shawshank Redemption, with The Green Mile was released in like chapter by chapter. Shawshank was based on the novella again. What over in the East they would call a light novel, you know, we call a novella. You know, The Body was a novella, became Stand By Me. Rita Hayworth and The Shawshank Redemption was a novella that became The Shawshank Redemption. You know, so how many other movies are out there that are based on Stephen King novellas? Is he like the greatest unknown writer in Hollywood?
Oh, wow.
We've just been informed it's about 45 films based on Stephen King novellas.
Wow.
That's crazy.
Yep, he deserves the medal.
Are there any writers in Hollywood that actually can boast that kind of input into the movie industry?
Well, in Hollywood, I don't know, but like in overall movie industry, I think maybe Arthur Conan Doyle. Like nearly all of his Sherlock Holmes works has been
that's a small, like very specific segment.
True.
Yeah, what we're talking about is across a broad number of genres.
Okay, yeah. No. Okay, that's true.
You know, as a writer, that kind of input into the movie industry is almost ridiculous.
It is, yeah.
45. And this is just the movie industry. You know?
Yeah. I mean, if you take into account TV as well.
If you take into account all the books he's written. Yeah, the thing is, when you break it down, you examine it, then he's very deserving of the National Medal of Arts.
But you've also got all the different adaptations by cartoons as well, like Simpsons adaptations, Family Guy adaptations.
They're not adaptations. They are basically homages. They're not adaptations.
Okay, so that's even better.
They're not adaptations. If it was an adaptation in The Simpsons, then, you know, it'd probably be a Treehouse of Horror thing.
Yeah.
But yeah, so...
So he's definitely well respected then, and
well, it's not that it's not about respect. It's about whether he's deserving. And when you break it down, you examine his career. Then yes, he is very, very deserving. It'd be difficult to find somebody who was actually more deserving.
Yeah, I can't argue with that.
But I think that what happens is people kind of prejudge him based on
because of those horror books
he's written.
Yeah, it's one of those things. He does get typecast a lot.
Yeah.
He does get typecast a lot.
Just like as a trashy horror writer.
Yeah. Kind of like P.G. James gets typecast as, you know, detective novel author. She writes about detective stories and stuff like that.
Sometimes there are occasions where typecast is necessary for certain authors.
No, it's never necessary.
J.K. Rowling, do you really think she could do anything other than wizard?
Yeah.
Really?
I honestly think J.K. Rowling sells herself short when she does stuff like The Casual Vacancy.
I mean, The Casual Racism.
Yeah, The Casual Racism. Sorry, thanks for correcting me. I honestly think, and this is one of the reasons why I get annoyed at her. Because, okay, there might be the whole issue with where did the Harry Potter story originally come from, you know, but ultimately what happened is that she had these ideas and, you know, regardless of how much help she got to write them, she still had those ideas in her head. They came from her.
Yeah.
Right? And if she has those ideas, then she can have other ideas that are actually better. You know, because it's a learning process. It's an evolution. It's never a static thing. But now with what's happened with The Casual Vacancy, she's going back and retreating back into the world of Harry Potter.
Yeah, and just trying to rehash all the stuff that made her famous in the first place.
You know, and I don't think that's going to work. I don't think that's going to work. It's like, it's basically The Hobbit, right?
Yeah.
Peter Jackson did Lord of the Rings. It was an amazing success. And he wanted to recapture that glory, so he went and did The Hobbit, which is a book that he separated into three different films, and it is just, no. It could have been done in one film.
Yeah, because it's not just that it's a book, it's that it's like a 500-page children's book.
Yes.
In which, like, the entirety of the third film happens in about 5 pages.
Basically, yeah.
I enjoyed that.
And Legolas was not in it at all.
No, I know.
And
I know
nobody knows why he was in there.
I know Legolas wasn't in it. I know that, Boren had a bigger part in the final battle.
Boren had a bigger part in the final battle, and there was no romance between the dwarf and the elf.
Nope.
We're not sure why that was in there.
Not really, no. That's a bit weird.
Yeah, we're not sure why that was in there, but yeah.
I think it was in there for, like, the same reason that most of the things were in there, to pad out the runtime.
See, the thing is, the final scene with Bilbo and Thorin Oakenshield, right, didn't take place on an icy plateau somewhere after he'd fought a giant orc. It took place in a tent.
Yeah.
Right? Because Thorin's body had been dragged from the battlefield, and he was in a tent. They'd done what they could, but he would, you know, ultimately they couldn't do anything. So his parting words with Bilbo, you know, were basically, the same as what they had in, almost the same as what they had in the movie, but yeah. It was in a tent, not on a battlefield.
No. He took a fair amount of artistic license, I will give you that. But.
And it was after they'd found Bilbo alive, after he got hit in the head by a rock, after seeing that the eagles were coming and shouting, "The eagles are coming! The eagles are coming!" You know, and then there was just this music going, "On a dark desert highway, cool wind in my hair." So yeah,
just don't. Just you can stop now.
See, that's the real reason why, like, the eagles couldn't take them all the way to Mount Doom in Lord of the Rings that they were going to. It's like, oh no, we have to listen to Hotel California constantly on repeat. Just let us off.
Basically,
where's the cassette player on this thing?
Yeah.
I mean, there are a couple of things. There are still some things that he kept, right? Like,
No. This bird only takes 8-track tapes. Oh. He just killed everyone though. That.
No, it's just a stunned silence.
The eagle only takes 8-track tapes.
Yeah. I.
What about when you need to flip it over?
He made it worse.
I didn't think it could get any worse. And then he just
the groundwork was
lower.
There. I had to build on it.
Even the Titanic couldn't sink lower than that.
All right. Okay. Yeah. So Stephen King, very deserving of this medal, I think. bringing it back on topic.
Because now we are going to talk. Go from a white man to a white Chinese man.
Yeah, I'm not sure how this works, right? The poet Yi Fen Cho. Now, you hear the name, you think, obviously, they are probably from the East, maybe yeah. China, maybe Korea, something like that, right?
Oh, sure, if you're going to make racist assumptions like that.
Well, it's part of the name. It's like, you know, my surname is Hok. So obviously you think I'm from the Indian subcontinent because that's where all the Hawks generally come from.
I thought you were a superhero.
Hey?
Hawk.
Hawk, not Hulk. I do not wear purple
Hawk.
Pants. Hey?
Hawk.
Hawk. I am not Hawkman.
You see, now you've finally got... You thought I said Hulk, but can we... Right,
but yeah, it's like, Owen, what's your surname?
Nicholson.
Nicholson, okay. So most people would assume that you're, with a surname like Nicholson, you'd either be from the United Kingdom or from America.
Yeah. Original last name's Lachlan, but...
Yeah, but you understand what I mean.
Yeah.
Your surname is Young?
No, I'll have you know it's Chang.
Chang, okay. Your surname is Chang, so you could be from China or somewhere like that. But if we went with your original surname before you changed it by deed poll, it was Young. So you could be from the United Kingdom... America, or even somewhere like Austria or Germany, because when we wouldn't know whether it was spelled Y-O-U-N-G or J-U-N-G.
Which is a problem I've had in the past.
Do you see what I mean?
Yeah.
So it's just with your name, you can kind of make a guess as to where people are from.
Yeah.
Right? So Yi Fen Cho wrote a poem, and it's caused an amazing amount of controversy within the poetry community. Now, we, last year, when Andy and I were doing Literary Loitering back on the old radio station we used to be on, we were amazed at the amount of scandal that happens within the poetry world. We just couldn't believe it because there was plagiarism, there was fraud in awards, and there was all sorts of stuff. And like, this is the world of poetry.
So the world of poetry is one of the most corrupt.
It was ridiculous. It's like there's people ripping other people off and winning awards for posting someone else, you know, providing someone else's poem and winning an award for that poem. But then the original author's coming forward saying, "Well, hang on, I wrote that poem, not him. So why haven't I won the award?" And you're like,
even just, every poet is just Tony Soprano.
Yeah,
even Sepp Blatter is disgusted with the amount of
corruption.
That's the word. Even Sepp Blatter is disgusted with the amount of corruption in the poetry industry.
No, I don't think he is. I don't think he's disgusted by the amount of corruption. I think Sad Bladder needs to go back to FIFA and stay with FIFA.
I think he needs to find a grave, but that's my opinion.
Nah, we don't want anything bad to happen to him.
I see. Do that while we're on radio, and no one will be the wiser.
Yes, yes, yes. No one could see me nodding my head on the radio, and maybe I shouldn't verbalize.
As a no, they'll never know.
As a no, they'll never know.
To be fair, the majority of football fans want to set Blatter out anyway, so I think you're on the winning side here.
Yeah, but they want to strap him to a rocket and fire him off into space.
What's wrong with that?
What's wrong with that? Is there pollute space?
Good point.
We'll get
there's enough trash in there already.
We'll get interstellar health and safety.
You cannot send this toxic filth into space. Yeah. What, the rocket? No, this man.
No. This being over here emitting this stench, you can't allow him into space. But we don't have anywhere to put him. You have nuclear waste. Bury him with that. So, yes, but then, you know, in like 100,000 years, the Blatter monster emerges from the pit.
Blatter, the toxic Avenger.
Oh, God.
The Blatter monster emerges to take his revenge on the world of football.
To be fair, by then we'll have already destroyed this planet and moved on.
No. Oh, he'll be met by Mecha Wayne Rooney. The Mecha Rooney, which is a combination of Wayne Rooney and Mickey Rooney.
Oh, wow. That's quite a leap.
The Mecha Rooney.
And then 1,000-year-old Ken Watanabe comes out of nowhere and yells out, "Let them fight."
Yes.
Gladiator, ready. Contender, ready.
No. Not gladiators. It'll be like the Godzilla punch-up, but it'll be like on the wastelands of somewhere.
Wow. Anyway,
I don't know how we ended up there from this news story, but let's get back to this news story. This is what happens. A controversy has continued to boil in the poetry community this week over the revelation that one of the poets included in this year's Best American Poetry Anthology was using the name Yifeng Cho, but that wasn't their real name. Right. Now, their real name is Michael Derek Hudson. He's a white guy. He is basically a genealogist at the Allen County Library in Fort Wayne, and his work has been published under his own name in several prestigious American literary journals, such as Poetry and North American Review. But he decided to use the name of an old high school classmate from Fort Wayne, Indiana. So Yifeng Cho is actually the name of a real person. And she has refused to speak out, but her sister Ellen has said, well, hang on, she's furious that some guy has basically decided to use her name without her permission.
Yeah, because that's not the same as just writing under a pseudonym, is it?
No. I mean, if you're going to... take Doctor Who, for example. He uses the name John Smith. Now, John Smith is the most common English name.
Yeah.
Right? It is the most common English name, John Smith.
Yeah.
You know, and that's why he uses it, because it's the most common English name. Anybody could be called John Smith. We could all change our names by deedpoll to John Smith, and no one would bat an eyelid.
No.
You know? And that's why he uses it. That's why it's used, because it's not going to upset anybody. You know, it's not like he's suddenly gonna say, you know, my name's Owen Nicholson.
I'd be furious.
Well, it's not that you'd be furious. You'd be like, oh, yeah, that's my name.
Oh, yeah.
But if you had a very, very unique name, like Yifeng Cho, you'd suddenly start asking questions, wouldn't you?
Yeah, I'd be asking, when do I get my prize?
Yeah.
Well, it's my name, so...
Especially when it's somewhere like Indiana, where I assume there's probably not an abundance of Yifeng Chos.
Well, here's the thing. A screenshot of his biographical note in the anthology began circulating on Monday, because he admitted using the pseudonym. And he admits to using the pseudonym whenever a poem of his has been rejected several times. He believed that using the pseudonym increased the chances of his being accepted. And this admission set off a host of criticism and jokes on social media. The reactions are a mixture of serious dismay and ironic frustration. The Asian American Writers Workshop, for example, produced a white pen name generator, which I'm going to go on. I must go on this. Meanwhile, Asian American poet Franny Choi wrote an affecting poem in response to the controversy exploring the difficult politics of Asian American names. Now, here's the thing, right? There's a couple of points that I want to raise about this story. Number one, if changing your name to something that isn't white increases your chances of your poem being accepted in a publication or a foreign award or something like that, then that really asks questions of the people in charge of that magazine, whatever it is, or in charge of the award, because that is kind of it's prejudiced.
It's
severely prejudiced, but it's that kind of positive prejudice,
yeah,
which people don't really class as prejudice, but actually is still prejudice.
Yeah.
Because it should be fair and based on the quality of the work, not on the name. Read the work first, and then look at the name. If you like the work, then look at the name of the author, of the poet or the author, and say, okay, right, okay, yeah, that's fine. I like this book. Basically, just remove the author's name entirely from this process.
Yeah, I mean, that's how it should be judged, is that someone should, like, get all the entries, then remove the names and then give them to the judges.
Yeah, I mean, you shouldn't add something just because you got a quarter to fill.
Well, it's not a quarter. It's got nothing to do with quarter. It's got everything to do with them wanting to be seen in the best light.
Yeah.
It's got everything to do with the public perception of them being fair to... and impartial. But the thing is,
Owen's point is, it is still kind of a quota in that they say, oh, we need to be fair, therefore we need to get, like, a black author and an Asian author.
Yes, you're right. Yeah. I see what you mean now when you say quota. Anyway, I think that they should just basically do it as a blind judging thing.
Yeah.
Yeah, and that's the only fair way to do it, is as a blind judge, a blind judging thing, because people's perceptions, people's biases are going to come to the fore, no matter what you do. It should be a blind judging panel or whatever it is. So there you go. We fixed it. We fixed your problem. We know how to fix it now.
Yeah, and it's ridiculous. It's such an easy fix.
Yeah, I know, but you know. Anyway,
loitering and making the solutions for you.
So yes, the white pen name generator is basically the Asian American writers, whatever it is, response to Michael Derek Hudson. It's basically just click on a button that says artistic legitimacy awaits. You click on the button and it just brings up a random name for you to use, like Norman Malone, Morgan Miller, Garrett Stewart, Brandon Bates, Amy Murphy, Caitlin Wesley, Connor Nicholson, Rachel Ambrose, Shannon Brady, Brandon Murphy, Mark Wood, Kelly Reed, and so on and so forth. You just click on on the button.
Oh, this is a game you could this is a sad game you can use. You just keep clicking until there's a name that you actually know someone who's that person.
Yes. Right.
It's a bit of a sad game, actually.
Any other news?
Yes. Since we've been kind of talking a bit about equal rights, we are now going to talk about kind of the one championing crusader for equal rights, Captain Underpants.
Yes.
Yes. Tell us about this. I've heard rumblings of strange disturbances in the world of underpants.
Yes. Basically, in the latest book, Captain Underpants and the Sensational Saga of Sir Stinks-a-Lot, the two main characters, Harold and George, meet their kind of future selves.
Okay.
And it's revealed that Harold grows up to marry a man.
Wow.
Wow, then.
Yeah.
That took a left turn.
But I think it's been praised for the way it's kind of just come out and said it without making a big deal.
I like the fact that they've just been, when I say taking a left turn, I don't mean that in a bad way. You know, taking a left turn means it's just come out of the blue. It's just basically they've just gone with it and said, yep, they haven't done any preamble, they haven't led up to it. They basically just said, yep, that's it.
Yeah, just.
And I applaud that. I think that's really bold of them.
Yeah, I mean, I've actually got the passage here that I'll just read out. Okay. Soon everyone had gathered together in old George's studio. Old George, his wife and their kids, Mina and Nick, sat on the couch, while old Harold, his husband and their twins, Owen and Kay, plopped down on the giant beanbag chair. Like,
that's just
it.
So matter-of-fact, it's ridiculous. Yeah. That's really good.
It doesn't just hang about. It just gives you the information.
It doesn't make a song and dance about it.
No.
And I think that's the important thing.
Yeah.
Is the fact that it hasn't made any attempt to draw attention to the fact that this has happened. It's just gone, right, this is a matter-of-fact thing.
Yep.
You know, deal with it, basically. They haven't made it. The thing is, the surprising thing is, there wasn't really a song and dance about it in the press either. You know, there wasn't all these, you know, like when they did the gay Green Lantern.
Yes, and everyone was kind of losing their minds over it.
But it was a Green Lantern in like the second or third DC universe, and you know, was it Alan, whatever his name was?
Alex, I actually don't even know what his last name is. But that's how little anyone cares about that.
Well, there was a big song and dance about it in the media about, oh, he's going to be gay, and you know, oh, this is striking another blow for equality. Well, okay, yeah, but there's no need to make a song and dance about it. Well, and that's why I prefer the way this has been done, because it's not making a song and dance about it. They've just basically written it in. That's it.
Because it's a normal thing that can happen.
Yeah.
What about Dumbledore? I mean, they did fairly much the same thing as well. When J.K. Rowling announced, oh yeah, he's gay, that came to be a big thing.
As I pointed out, she announced that after the books had been published, all of a sudden, you know, she, and I honestly don't like the fact she announced it after the books had been
published. It wasn't mentioned in the books, it was mentioned after.
Yeah.
It's basically pandering to a fan base without any risk to the books themselves.
Yeah. If she'd said that before,
it would have more legitimacy.
I would have more respect for it, and I would believe it more if she'd said it, say, after the fifth book or after the sixth book. Yeah.
It did seem like she was kind of trying to make it more, like, trying to push more quality into her book by just giving some information after the fact.
The books had enough equality as it is.
Aye.
You know, they didn't need any more. They had enough equality as it was. You know, I mean, throwing in the fact that one of the primary characters is gay is just kind of, I mean, nobody complained about it.
No.
Nobody had an issue with it.
Apart from the one guy who got a tattoo and regretted it after he found out. Got a tattoo of Dumbledore, then he kind of regretted it after finding out.
Yeah, but that's the thing. That's one guy, and that's after the fact. Well, while the books were being published, nobody raised it as an issue.
No.
Nobody had a problem with it. Everybody just kind of went, well, it's a world dealing with wizards and witches, and they've got dragons and griffins and stuff like that. Maybe some of the characters are gay. Maybe they aren't. We don't care. We've got dragons. We've got magic. You know, who cares about gender politics when you've got dragons? It really is that simple.
That is such a good point. Why care about anything else? Dragons!
Yes!
I'm just so caught up with the fact that Voldemort doesn't have a nose.
Yeah, I know. That was and that was another thing.
I mean, isn't he just supposed to be a person? Yeah. Like,
my Voldemort has no nose. Well, how does he smell? Terrible.
Wow. Are we just not going to talk about Voldemort and his rampant drug problem? His rampant cocaine use?
No, he didn't have rampant cocaine use. He didn't have a body to use cocaine with. that's some demonic reconstructive surgery there.
A little bit, yes.
See what I did there?
Yes.
I've cracked it. The entire Harry Potter series is just Tom Riddle in a crack den somewhere dreaming the whole thing up.
Wow.
Oh, that could work, actually. Anyway, how'd we get onto that?
Through Captain Underpants.
Yes. Anyway, Captain Underpants, I applaud the fact that they've been very, very matter-of-fact with it. Anyway, we're going to move on to our book review. Do we have one or two?
I think just the one this week.
Just the one this week, okay. And this week, it is... I really didn't want to read it, but I knew I had to, and I really wanted to, but I didn't want to at the same time, because if I read it and once you read it and finish it, then you have to accept the fact that he's really gone.
Yeah.
This is Terry Pratchett's final book, The Shepherd's Crown, which is the fifth book in the series dealing with Tiffany Aching and the Witches of Lancre. Now, in this book, it starts off with the finding of a fossil that looks like it's in the shape of a crown. Now, when they say a crown, they don't mean like the pointy type crown. They mean kind of the Queen's crown?
Kind of
like that, right?
Basically more like a hat.
Yeah, more like a hat. And this fossil was picked up by one of the Achings a long time ago. and was left on the shelf in the Aiking household, and it's been passed down from generation to generation of Aikings, and it deals once again with fairies. Fairies are part of this story. We're not just the Nac MacFeagle, the little blue fellas who are basically pixies, because, you know,
the wee free men.
Yeah, even thistles need fairies. That's the whole point of it, you know. Even thistles need fairies, and you know, their favorite things are drinking and fighting and stealing, and their most favorite thing is drinking and fighting and stealing all at once.
Well, these are not fairies I've ever heard of.
That's because they're pixies, spelled P-I-C-T. S-I-E-S.
Okay.
You know, like the Scots, the Picts, the Celts.
Yes.
Yeah, that kind of thing.
Yes.
They'll have cousins like the Scotsies and the Celties. We're not sure. They may have relatives like that. But anyway, it starts off, Tiffany feels something strange is happening through her really good boots. Something strange is happening to the world, and she feels it through the chalk. And she goes to speak to the Kelder, who is basically the matriarch of the Nac MacFeagle, and the Kelder has also noticed it. There's a circle of stones on the chalk, and it's kind of a doorway that protects this world from other worlds that are on the boundary of the world. Ultimately, in Pratchett's Discworld, witches protect the edges of things, the boundaries of the world. You know, they're the guardians of the border between life and death, between light and dark, between this world, the next, that sort of thing. And then it gets to chapter two.
Yes, which you pretty much shoved the book at me and told me to read.
Because I could not talk about it until you read it. And it is such a major event. And the thing is, at the end of the book, there's an afterword by Rob Wilkins, who was his editor and one of his closest friends, right? And he talks about how Pratchett used to have several books on the go at once. And, you know, the beginning, the middle, and the end of this book were all complete. But you notice when you're reading the book that it's not quite at the same kind of polish as other Pratchett books. And obviously we know the reason why. And Rob Wilkins actually says, you know, this isn't the complete book. This isn't the final version of what Pratchett intended. Everything is there. The core elements of the story are there. All of that stuff is there. But it's also a bit kind of predictive as well. The fact that there is such a major event in chapter two.
Yeah, which definitely, when you read it in the context of Terry Pratchett passing away, adds a whole new layer to it.
Yeah, I know. And it's like, and we're not talking, I mean, the way he wrote it in the second chapter is just kind of, oh, wow. You know, when you've got Hex trying to work out the effects of that event without any input whatsoever.
It almost reads a bit autobiographical.
Yeah, it's crazy. And just how respectful the character who came was.
Yes.
You know, just how respectful he's like, oh, wow. And, yeah, the events that happen afterwards, it's just kind of everybody is trying to cope with this major event, which I really can't spoil, but you and me can talk about afterwards. But it's basically how the rest of how the witches and everyone else on the Discworld is trying to cope with this major, major event. And in the middle of that, the fairies attack. A fairy called Peas Blossom leads an attack on the world. The fairies are determined to come back, but somewhere along the way, the Queen of the Fairies, Nightshade, makes friends with Tiffany. A fairy making friends with somebody who's not a fairy has never been heard of before.
Yeah, yeah. I really want to read this.
Yeah.
And you're hoarding it from me, and you're a bad man for doing it.
But yeah, as I said, it doesn't feel as polished as other Pratchett books, but obviously we know the reasons for that. But still, there's something indefinable about reading a Pratchett book. There's something really difficult to explain, especially if you're a fan. They're really well written. The humor is really on the nose. Yeah, you know, the humor is really, really on the nose, because he understands exactly how humor works when it's in written form. You know, and it's difficult to convey a particular joke in kind of a spoken form. But when it's written in the book, I mean, it's like the Knack McFeagle, call humans big jobs.
Yes.
And I love that name for humans. And I actually started using it myself to describe people for a while. I used to go around calling them big jobs because...
Oh, there's a guy in my college course who's really tall, and I think I've just found his nickname.
Do you see what I mean? they're using terms that are kind of familiar but unfamiliar at the same time because they are supposed to be a little bit Scottish, you know. So they use terms like scunner and stuff like that. And you're like, yeah, okay. And the way they talk and the cadence of the speech and the way they name each other. I the Knack McFeagle have very few names, but they really make them go a long way. Like, you know, not as wee as wee jock jock, but bigger than wee jock jock jock.
Yes.
No, I can't follow it either. And, you know, when Tiffany first meets him, she makes a mistake of calling him Wee Jock. He's like, no, I'm not Wee Jock. I'm not Wee Jock. I'd love to be Wee Jock, but I'm, not as wee as Wee Jock Jock, but bigger than Wee Jock. Wee Jock Jock Jock. I don't know what's going on. This name takes up half a page.
Wow. I've got a bit of a question of this. You say now it's still a bit rough around the edges.
It is still a bit rough around the edges, but as obviously we know why that's the case.
But are you happy it's like that rather than them getting another author to write, polishing them up?
No. You're absolutely right on that. I am happy that they didn't get another author to try and polish this up.
Good.
And I hope that if there's any other unfinished works, I'd love to read them in their raw form.
Yeah.
I'd love to read them as they are, because at the end of the day, in 50 years' time, in 100 years' time, Pratchett is going to be one of the authors that's referred to as one of the greats.
Yeah.
His books have already been turned into plays. They've already had TV movies made of them. I'd love to see a proper Hollywood production of some of the Pratchett stuff. Yes. I mean, there's so much you could do with the Discworld on a Hollywood scale.
Yeah.
I mean, can you imagine the guards?
Oh, God, I'm practically drooling thinking about it.
Yeah, can you imagine Sam Vimes?
If they could do Lord of the Rings, they can do this.
Yeah, but the thing is, there are so many Pratchett fans in the world. It's kind of ridiculous just how many Pratchett fans there are. There are video games about the Discworld. There are toys. There are board games. We have one on the shelf over there.
Yeah.
Discworld is probably one of the most enduring fictional creations ever.
Yeah,
There will come a time when it will basically become the go-to place for fantasy rather than Middle Earth.
Uh-huh.
I reckon that time will come because it's already on the cards.
Yeah.
I don't think there's a bigger fictional reality at this moment in time. The only real rival to it would be Harry Potter.
Yeah.
I'd say.
Yeah, but I feel like Discworld is definitely going to last on after Harry Potter's faded away.
I think Discworld has that advantage of because it's one of those fictional creations that has evolved over the course of how many books is it now?
Oh,
isn't it like 40 books?
It's got to be somewhere around that.
It's around 40, maybe 50 books. It's a ridiculous number of books, and you know, then you've got all the games, then you've got the Sky movies. Then you've got the graphic novels, the plays, you know, and then there's the fan fiction. Oh, my God, Discworld fan fiction.
Let's not talk about the fan fiction.
No, what I'm saying is it's like the fan fiction is heading towards, you know, the old Star Wars Expanded Universe levels.
Oh, that is interesting.
Just in terms of the scope of it.
Wow.
Right, yeah. Just in terms of the number of stories based in the Discworld. I mean, he wrote about everything. I mean, his book Raising Steam, they actually refer to the railways in this, by the way, but his book Raising Steam was dealing with, you know, steam engines. And before that, he had like, I forgot what it was. It was Snuff before then. And in between that, he wrote Dodger and, you know, he had a couple of short story things published. And then there was Unseen Academicals, which is
a football novel.
Yeah, and it's actually hilariously good as well. It's really funny, but it deals with football. Like, how do you make this work in a fantasy world? But he made it work.
Only Terry Pratchett.
Yeah, but this is the thing. In terms of how clever he was and how versatile he was and how much he could turn just a normal mundane thing into something that you really wanted to read about.
Yeah.
You know, because let's put it this way. Unseen Academicals was for a lot of geeks their first real foray into the world of football. That's based, and I'm not kidding you on that, because they probably don't follow football themselves, but then they pick up Unseen Academicals and they're reading a book that's all about football.
Wow.
So yeah.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
You know, I mean, the stuff like Going Postal, which is about a guy setting up a post office.
Yeah.
And it's amazing.
And you know what? You remember Kevin Costner's movie, The Postman?
Yeah.
Yeah, well, if he'd done it as Going Postal, it would have been amazing.
Wow.
And what was it after that? It was Making Money, wasn't it?
Yes. Well, like, he goes into like the signals.
He goes into the banking industry, and I love the trial at the end when you got the little dog being vibrated across the floor by that device that vibrates that he thinks is a chew toy. And Moist von Lipwig's, everyone's looking at it, and Moist von Lipwig's like, I'm in a world where that just happened, you know, and nobody's batted an eyelid.
Wow.
I can do whatever the hell I want now. It's kind of liberating. And then he takes a custard pie to the face.
Wow. Yeah, my dad was on, except Terry Pratchett. I can't think of any other authors that have made such an impact around the world and people. So I was like, my dad was one of those people where he read these when he was younger. They kind of helped him escape
It is pure escapism, but it's escapism with a point. I mean, Pratchett did a lot of humour, but there was always a point to the humour. There was always something to learn. Let's put it this way. If you talk to people who read Harry Potter, talk to the people who read Harry Potter when they were a kid.
Yeah.
Right? You ask them, what did you learn from Harry Potter? And they'll basically give you the typical kind of shonen anime manga type answer. You know, believe in your friends, you know, your friends will support you and everything like that. You must fight the power.
Really? Because what I learned was if anyone dies,
you can bring them back with Dragon Balls.
Yes, various things like that.
What I learned was...
Because there is a Dragon Ball in Harry Potter. It is basically a Dragon Ball, isn't it?
Wow. See, what I learned was, if you ever play chess, don't play against a ginger. They are ruthless.
Nah, they're not. Trust me.
I don't know. Ron Weasley's a bit ruthless when it comes to chess.
Nah. Because you're talking about Ron when he was a kid. Yeah. And seriously, if he was up against somebody, because you got to think about it like this. He's ruthless, but his opponent was basically one of those little chess machines. Right, his opponent wasn't a human being who could lean over and punch him in the face.
Good point.
I'll give him a wedgie. That would distract him.
that is quite the distraction.
Yes.
That's quite the distraction.
Do you see my point?
If now my underwear's over my eyes, this is quite the distraction.
What, they went atomic with the wedgie, didn't they?
By like a bully.
Might as
Isn't
well.
That an atomic wedgie where you pull it up so far you can put it over the top of the head?
Yeah. This is all because of American kids' programs that teaches this kind of stuff.
Yes.
So this is the lost Harry Potter book, Harry Potter and the Locker of Loneliness.
Harry Potter and the Atomic Wedgie. So, yes. But this is the thing. If you talk to people about what they learned from Harry Potter, they'll have learned something. But if you talk to people about what they learned from Discworld, it's usually very, very different.
Yeah.
You know, what could you learn from Sam Vimes, for example? What I learned from Sam Vimes was control your anger, keep hold of it, and use it when you need it. That's not something that you're going to learn from Harry Potter. And do you know where I learned that from? Night Watch.
Wow.
Because there's a scene in Night Watch where he breaks into, you know, the Unmentionables or whatever they're called. He breaks into there and he finds all the prisoners. Or what's left of them.
Yeah.
And that's when, you know, that's when all that anger starts pouring out and he forces himself to control it. And I thought, wow, that's one hell of a message, you know. don't let it all out at once. It's yours. It's your ability. It's your weapon. It's not its own thing. It belongs to you. So use it when you need it. They'll put a leash on it. And various other things. Sam Vimes is a very good teacher in a certain sense. Yeah. And then Esme Weatherwax, the things you learn from her about duty and about, you know, about only taking what's owed and always giving back what you owe, things like
yeah,
that.
Yeah, doing the right thing for the sake of doing the right thing and not for a reward.
Yeah, stuff like that. That's not stuff that you learn from, you know, that you can learn from something like Harry Potter. No. There's lots of things like that. I mean, from Rincewind. Hell, what can you learn from Rincewind?
The importance of running away.
Yes, the best things to do when running away. Number one, don't look back. Number two, the important thing is what you're running away from. Doesn't matter about where you're running to. Number three, it's not heights that kill you. It's the grounds. Don't be scared of heights. Be scared of grounds.
That's quite something. Don't be scared of heights, even if you've fallen off them. Be scared of the ground that's heading towards you at increasing speed.
Yes, if you could punch a hole through the ground and keep falling, you would. So, yeah, you know, but even Rincewind taught, you know, even from Rincewind, you could learn that even the greatest coward can have some degree of courage. I mean, in sorcery, when he goes to rescue the sorcerer, and he attacks the creatures from the from whatever dimension they're in. He attacks them with half a sock and a brick. And he is attacking them with that. And he's got no reason to be there. He's got nothing to gain by being there, and he's a total coward, and yet he's still going through with it.
Yeah, because at the end of the day, he's still a good guy.
Yeah. You know, he's not a tool.
Well, you say that. Luggage is a tool, and luggage is still awesome.
Yeah, but, you know, the luggage is just kind of, yeah. I love the luggage. The luggage is probably, aside from death, luggage is probably one of my favorite characters on Discworld, because it's just so vindictive and so nasty and evil, and it will basically stomp anything into a squishy paste on the floor. And then probably my third favorite would be Grebo, Nanny Ogg's cat.
Oh, yeah.
That will attempt to fight and possibly even rape everything up to a four horse-drawn logging cart.
Wow.
Yeah, it's a cat. It's just a normal cat. It's like the most evil cat in the world.
This isn't Puss in Boots, is it?
No. This is the most evil cat in the world. If Puss in Boots met Grebo, Grebo would bend him over. Let's put it that way. They'd be yowling in the night.
Okay.
And then Grebo would steal his boots.
Now I'm sad we never got the inevitable showdown between Grebo and Luggage.
See, that I think Grebo and Luggage would get on quite well.
Well, no, it'd be like your classic superhero crossover where initially they fight, but then they realize they're basically the same and just cause havoc around Discworld.
There's a song of that, Grebo and Luggage, heading off to sort.
Or like a 70s buddy cop show.
You saying Luggage has a mustache? Are you going to make like the patrician, the chief of police?
Yes.
Damn you, Luggage, you don't play by the rules, but you get results.
Well, that's a show that needs to be made.
Pratchett, I could keep talking about Pratchett all day, but we are unfortunately at the end of the show, so I'm gonna have to cut it short there. The Shepherd's Crown is available now from all good bookshops, and I highly advise everybody who's a Pratchett fan to buy it and read it, because it is well worth it.
And if you know a Pratchett fan like I do, it'll make a great Christmas present.
It'll make a great present. Don't bother waiting for Christmas.
Well,
seriously, I would not bother waiting for Christmas. No. I'd say early Christmas present for you.
Oh, there you go.
Okay. Because, yeah, you don't want to wait to read this book.
No.
The major event in Chapter 2 means you don't want to wait to read this book, because you will be left out of the conversation. Trust me on that. And that's why I let Andy read it, because I didn't want him being left out of the conversation.
Well, then I'd best start reading the books then.
You got a lot of catching up to do if you haven't read it.
I have quite a lot of catching up to do.
Yes. Anyway, right. We shall leave you there. We're going to head off and do other things now. We have been Literary Loitering, and you can find us on the Geek Show Podcast Network and on our Mixcloud channel. So, yes, I have been Rob.
I've been Andrew.
And I've been Owen.
We'll see you all next week.